Well, here we go, Andrew. The epidemiology of cardiovascular disease begins our syllabus. Any general comments on how common it is, just the numbers that we should bear in mind?
Cardiovascular disease is a major health problem in the United States. More than 80 million adult Americans have cardiovascular disease, and about half of these patients are older than the age of 60.
So if you're over age 60, the chances are at least 50-50 you've got some.
That's correct, some form of cardiovascular disease.
Let's see, incidence of first cardiovascular event, again, goes up with age. We're looking at figure one, where you can see the dramatic increase with each decade, and women seem to lag about a decade behind men as far as the, for example, a 50-year-old man's risk is about the same as a 60-year-old woman sort of thing.
That's right, although women, because their projected lifespan is greater than men, cardiovascular disease still represents the major cause of mortality in women.
So for a woman, what's the average lifetime risk for her to develop cardiovascular disease?
It's approximately 1 in 2 for a woman to develop cardiovascular disease.
And we think about guys more as far as ischemic heart disease, but actually each year in the U.S., more women die of ischemic heart disease than men.
That's a very important point. I think that there are a number of studies that suggest that cardiovascular disease in women is under-recognized and perhaps under-treated even by physicians. About 1 in 3 women die of cardiovascular disease, compared to 1 in 5 women dying from cancer-related deaths.
What we've seen in the last 25 years, the number of cardiovascular deaths among men has dropped significantly, but the number among women has been staying about the same, essentially unchanged.
That's a very key finding.
What about ethnicity? Any considerations there regarding risk of cardiovascular disease?
The prevalence of coronary heart disease does differ based on ethnicity. It's highest among American Indians and Alaskan Natives, likely related to the very high prevalence of diabetes in those patient populations, and followed by Hispanics and then whites and blacks.
I mentioned the risk factors playing into the ethnicity angle. Two or more risk factors for heart disease and stroke are found in about half of blacks and American Indians, Alaskan Natives, but only half that, about 25% of Asian adults.
Yes, I think that the ethnicity is a very broad and nonspecific marker for the cardiovascular risks that go into future cardiovascular events.
Prevalence of hypertension also has a spread. 16% of Asians, roughly a third of the American population. For Asians, is it 16%, Hispanics, Latinos, 19%. Whites, 32%, blacks, 41%. Prevalence among American blacks is among the highest in the world. In the U.S., compared with whites, blacks develop high blood pressure at a younger age, have higher average blood pressure measurements, carry a much greater risk of end-organ complications, such as end-stage kidney disease or stroke.
That's correct, and a significant higher risk of developing left ventricular hypertrophy and heart failure related to hypertension.
Diabetes and also collagen vascular disease are two very interesting risk factors for developing cardiovascular disease. In the U.S., about 1 person in 10 has diabetes, and most of those, 95% of type 2. And it's been frightening to see the increase in the prevalence of diabetes. Just since 1990, it's increased by 61%.
That rate of increase is very alarming and likely related to a number of lifestyle factors that we'll discuss more, including decreased activity, diet changes, the increase in overweight and obesity.
Supersize Me, the movie, is a good example of that phenomenon. And then with diabetes, we're getting more and more intense about watching for and treating microalbuminuria. That's a huge increase in the risk factor.
Yes, a very sensitive marker for the negative effect of diabetes on the microvasculature.
I've seen it advocated that you start with ACE inhibitor, titrate it up. If you max out on that, then you add the ARB and you use an ARB with an ACE inhibitor, kind of treating microalbuminuria like you do trying to treat to a target LDL. You try to just keep incrementally increasing until you get it under control, obviously trying to optimize blood sugar control as well.
Yes, I think microalbuminuria is a very powerful risk marker.
Any comments on metabolic syndrome and heart disease?
Metabolic syndrome, I think, is something that we all recognize on a very gestalt level. We walk into a room and say, hey, that patient has metabolic syndrome.
Right.
I think it is useful to review the diagnostic criteria for metabolic syndrome so that we perhaps can be a little bit even more sensitive to the diagnosis and recognizing that this may be, although not yet, a defined risk factor for future cardiovascular disease. So the diagnosis of metabolic syndrome is made based on 5 risk factors, and a patient must have 3 or more of them to meet the criteria for metabolic syndrome. These risk factors include a fasting plasma glucose level greater than 100 milligram per deciliter, HDL cholesterol level less than 40 milligram per deciliter in men or 50 in women, a triglyceride level greater than or equal to 150 milligram per deciliter.
And again, that's fasting.
That's correct. Thank you. A waist circumference that's greater than 40 inches in men or 35 inches in women, and a blood pressure that's greater than or equal to 130 millimeters of mercury systolic or 85 millimeters of mercury diastolic, or drug treatment for hypertension. So when you look at all those risk factors, I think that we all can say, hey, there are a lot of patients in my practice who have 3 or more of those risk factors.
Yeah, very common. All right, cancer and cardiovascular disease, big points here. If you have a childhood cancer survival who's had radiation therapy, that can lead to accelerated atherosclerosis. Anybody that's been treated with doxorubicin or any other anthracycline, they have increased risk of cardiomyopathy and CHF. You'll see those agents used for acute leukemia, lymphomas, and breast cancers typically.
As a practicing cardiologist, the 2 major long-term consequences we see are exactly that. Patients who have been treated with anthracyclines in the past and the risk of developing cardiomyopathy, both acutely but also long-term, as well as those treated with significant radiation therapy involving the thorax.
There's one new twist to this that has to do with breast cancer and something called HER2, HER2 receptor protein. Breast cancer cells that have this are more aggressive, and there's a specific monoclonal antibody directed against the HER2 protein called trastuzumab, and there's a cardiac twist to trastuzumab.
Yes, it has been associated with up to nearly 30% incidence of cardiac dysfunction or heart failure. So screening patients before initiation of this treatment for patients with breast cancer with an echocardiogram to assess their left ventricular dysfunction and obviously a careful history is very important.
In a very high-risk group is the patients that have been getting both trastuzumab but also an anthracycline. That combo is like a double whammy. Patients with any kind of systemic inflammatory condition, you know, this whole thing about checking C-reactive protein and treating that. In addition, you know, statins will lower C-reactive protein. Using that as an additional endpoint in addition to the LDL, at least in some patients, has been gaining traction. And I think this is partly the reason for it. Patients with lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, systemic sclerosis, pretty much any kind of collagen vascular inflammatory condition can be at risk of cardiovascular disease and valvulopathies also in some cases.
That's correct. Whereas we generally use the C-reactive protein in patients that are otherwise healthy to assess their risk of future cardiovascular events, it's well recognized that patients who would otherwise have an elevated C-reactive protein due to a chronic inflammatory condition are at higher risk of future cardiovascular events.
We hit some of this in the rheumatology syllabus, but I'd like to look at Table 1 together and do sort of a call response thing where I'll give you the condition and you give me the cardiac involvement and prevalence. So the first one, systemic lupus erythematosus.
The most common cardiac complication would be pericardial involvement, either pericardial effusion, pericarditis, a very low likelihood of developing constrictive pericarditis. There's a risk of developing valvular damage due to non-infective endocarditis or what's called Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis, and that may affect the competency of the valves leading to regurgitation. As you pointed out in our earlier discussion, patients with lupus are at a much higher risk of coronary artery disease and myocardial infarction, and recognizing this should lead to aggressive risk factor modification.
Yeah, I've heard some advocate that patients with active lupus should be regarded as patients with diabetes or with confirmed ischemic heart disease as far as your LDL targets and how aggressively you want to use preventive therapy for them.
Yes. Cardiovascular events is one of the major reasons for reduced survival in patients with lupus.
Well, actually, it's the number one killer. Most patients with lupus die of heart disease.
Interesting.
Yeah. Rheumatoid arthritis?
Again, often affects the pericardium, resulting in pericardial effusion. Patients often develop coronary artery disease, fibrosis of the valve leaflets, and myocardial involvement, typically with diastolic dysfunction.
Ankylosing spondylitis.
Typically affects the aorta, so patients may develop a dilated aorta, and because of that also develop insufficiency of the aortic valve, leading to aortic regurgitation.
So you want to watch their echo. Systemic sclerosis.
Cardiovascularly, the most common complication would be pulmonary arterial hypertension. Other conditions that may be associated include myocardial fibrosis, pericardial disease, and obviously systemic hypertension if it involves the renal vasculature.
One that we don't see that often but is really dramatic when you can make the diagnosis, Takayasu's arteritis.
Yes, typically affects large vessels in the body. So the aorta would be commonly affected. The coronary arteries may be affected in up to 25% of patients with Takayasu's arteritis. It can also lead to involvement of the pulmonary arteries.
Giant cell arteritis.
May be associated with peripheral arterial disease and cerebral vessels leading to stroke, as well as coronary arteries leading to myocardial infarction.
Polyarteritis nodosa?
It's been associated with a cardiomyopathy, although not commonly.
Kawasaki's disease.
Kawasaki's disease is a condition that affects children predominantly. There is a treatment to prevent the development of its feared complications of coronary artery aneurysms and subsequent occlusion.
Behçet's disease.
Behçet's disease may affect a number of different regions of the heart, including the aortic valve, the myocardium, the pericardium, as well as the conduction system.
And finally, sarcoidosis.
Sarcoidosis is an infiltrative process leading to granuloma formation throughout the body, including the myocardium. And when it affects the myocardium, can lead to either a dilated or a restrictive cardiomyopathy. Oftentimes, these patients will present with conduction abnormalities and most commonly ventricular arrhythmias.
The audio presentations you just heard are from MixApp 15 Audio Companion, presented by the American College of Physicians and Oakstone Medical Publishing. Learn how the MixApp 15 Audio Companion can save you time and money and help you earn up to 90 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. We offer a special discount to ACP members. Please call 800-633-4743 or visit our website at www.mixapaudio.com. That's MKSAPaudio.com for more information.